you bringing up the Nathaniel Rivers interview, it has me thinking about the conversation that they have at the very end. Remember that when Rickard talks about how music was a really important part throughout the whole book, and really, it's wonderful that the ways that he kind of sprinkles in music.
Absolutely, and there are even places where the insights of punk and of, you know, 70s rock and all these other things were put alongside philosophy, and Rickard a couple times kind of throws in a sentence defending that, saying, of course these people have insights into the way the world works, the way the world reveals itself to us, and the way we attune ourselves to that. I think that's the way he would put it. Of course, everyone has insight to that, including and maybe especially musicians.
It doesn't just stop there either. Rickard also, besides this kind of attentiveness to sound and the use of some sonic examples, which we'll get to in just a moment, he also uses this sonic language throughout, which I think is no accident. Even the word attunement itself is resonant and asks us to think about the ways things sound together or are tuned together. Another term that he uses frequently is the word key, as in the key of G, but he'll say the key of or an ambient key or a rhetorical key, as a way of talking about not necessarily a singularity or a monotone, but the ways that that rhetoric itself is multitonal and chordal, and you know that it has these structures that work outside of just a singular linear space.
And I think even if you don't think of yourself as a musician, if you don't think of yourself as someone who has all the musical words, I think you know when the key changes in a song. I'm also thinking of a couple of other musical metaphors in chapter 2, which is about a new way to think about Kairos. At one point, Rickard writes, "I return to ancient Greek thought to restore a materialist tonality that has been waylaid in history." That's again thinking about the tonality is the whole musical language that goes into a piece. A certain major tonality will have a very different feel from a minor tonality or even some other kind of tonality that isn't Western. Later in that chapter, he even describes Kairos as a kind of harmony. So again, he's constantly, I think purposely, trying to remind us of the ways that this, again, is bigger than music, but includes music and maybe especially includes music.
Yeah, and not just music, I think, but I mean, there are several musical examples, but there's also just this idea of sound and sound space, mm-hmm. and place in particular. There's a fantastic example early on about the famous caves.
The cave paintings, right?
Yeah, the cave paintings of, what is that cave again?
I want to say Lascaux. Is that how you say it in French? I don't know.
But just this new discovery that space wasn't just a place where there was visual art represented for the first time, but that space as a resonant space was just as important to understanding that particular the culture that produced it. Another one, and this is more contemporary, is early on he talks about the iconic drum sound on Led Zeppelin's "When the Levee Breaks," and the space that particular recording was made. This Headley Grange in East Hampshire, England, but the sound of the drums was achieved not just through the space, but by also like very careful microphone placement throughout the room that had created this sound.
Right, and that's a material affordance of the place, and it's not something that was designed in a classical rhetorical sense, right? Like yes, there's a sense in which where the mics were placed and how they decided to do it showed the rhetorical purposefulness of the subjects who were trying to create the sound they wanted, right? But it's also an example, and this is, I think, what Rickard wants to say, that it's an example of that space, in a sense, speaking for itself. It's disclosing itself. And not completely. There's still parts of it that we don't always understand and we can't control that withdraw from our understanding. But if we pay attention to what that space can say, what that space can add, what that space can mean to us, then I don't know, I guess he would say that's an example of us attuning ourselves to the ambience of a space and its potential.
Yeah, this discussion reminds me actually of a movie I just saw called Muscle Shoals, which
I
is about
seen it.
it's about this recording studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that has produced just hundreds of amazing records. You know, you get people like Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones talking about just the specialness of the place.
Yeah.
How he would go there, and there was just something about the place. And they talk about the soil, and they talk about the river that passes through it. And not just like the great producer or the great, you know, the room that they play in, or even this band that... you know, that worked in this area, but literally that it had to do something about this place.
Yeah. And I really think that's a good intro to move into talking a little bit about chapter one and chapter two. Chapter one's about the Kora, the Greek concept, and two about Kairos. Let's talk a little bit about the Kora first and the way that he wants us to revise it. And I actually have a quote here that I think might help us get going on that. On page 55, he says that ambience can never be understood simply as presence. Place is not simply an immediate environment. It includes the background by means of which things show up as what they are. What does that quote do for you?
I'm just keep on going back to Pearl Jam. You know, it's hard not to, you know, because it just reminds me of not just Wrigley, not just the experience of listening to one of my favorite Pearl Jam songs, Release, when we first got there. It's still daylight outside. The music starts. All of a sudden, I'm transported back to the first time that I heard that song, you know, it was like my first CD player at home.
Yeah.
And that, I know that other people are having that same experience of place and not just physical space, but place and time.
Well, and I think that's what Kora does for him. He doesn't want to just talk about place. He wants to talk about the ways that Ulmer, the ways that Kristeva have helped us see new ways of thinking about Kora. It draws attention to that stuff you're just talking about.
Yeah, this idea of Kora is interesting in that, you know, it shines the spotlight on place, but it also demands of us to think really carefully about what place is, mm-hmm. and how it's meaningful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this reminds me of some work I've been doing recently in vernacular music. For example, the vernacular music that comes from the African-American tradition is oftentimes focused on activity. So you have work songs that help to keep the time of certain activities that were done, on a cotton plantation or something like that. Yeah. But they're also oftentimes embedded within those locations. They talk about things like the heat of the sun, the materiality of the cotton, the pain that of experiencing the work, all of those kind of ambient additions to just the song itself as an artifact. What's really interesting about these is that they index not just the African Americans' experiences in the prisons or on Jim Crow plantations, but also, you know, as scholars like Amiri Baraka have noted, they index the experience of slave life itself and kind of go, I guess, so in other words, Kora, I think if we were to understand it correctly, we need to understand it both in terms of current place, but also place in time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, all the places that have built up to that moment. And you know, what I would even say that you're more of the expert on those folk songs than I am, but I do know that the Lomaxes traveled around and brought their giant recording equipment with them to
right.
record, sometimes onto aluminum, right? And mm-hmm. so just the idea of how both the cultural situatedness of that idea of this white father and son team traveling around to African American prisons, but also the materials they were bringing and the ways they were recording and how I would assume that anything you listen to now, you can hear echoes of that machinery that they use, those materials.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the really fascinating things about the sonic archive.
Sonic moments like that have that complex of a meaning. I think that's part of what Rickard is trying to draw our attention to with the whole notion of ambience, is that, hey, there are so many ambient things going on in any situation. It would be silly to assume that we can identify exactly the affordances of any single place, any single choric moment. And I think he really applies that to Kairos, too, in the next chapter, where he really has an issue with Here's a quote from page 85. He doesn't like when contemporary theories of Kairos, quote, rely on an opportunistic frame, one that reinscribes it in a narrative of subjective control or advantage. And I think his issue with that that narrative of subjective control is that we assume that a moment comes to us and then we dive in and take advantage of it. When I think he would say that really Kairos needs to be understood almost, I don't know if this is too mysterious, but almost as if Kairos has its own sort of agency, as if the Kairos is something that is already there. And again, here's another quote that in some way the Kairos does what it does to us, with us and alongside us. It's on page 90. And there's something related there to what you're saying, that to understand this, we have to understand the ways that it was kairotic beyond anyone's control.
So wait, are you saying that a rhetor's decision is somehow willed by Kairos? Is it fate?
Well, Rickert really specifically says it's not. He even has this, no, I am not going for some new objective determinism, even though it sort of sounds like it here and there, right? But I think he would probably say, even though we're not controlled by Kairos, it's not fate. It's not that everything we say is predetermined. It's still more complicated than the idea of us reaching in and taking control.
Right. He uses these words on page 91. He says that it's a highly nuanced set of relations among language, environment, and people, and which I think is part of what's fun about it, is that it does seem to almost emerge as, you know, as serendipity in some ways, that there is this kind of interesting, Kairos has a serendipitous flavor sometimes.
But what that makes me think of is I was writing a blog post the other day about REM, and maybe that's a little related here. I was thinking about my personal history with REM, my personal history with the Materialities, how the first two albums that I got on CD of REM were actually their first two albums, Murmur and Reckoning. But I had been an REM fan for years before I ever got those, and all the ones I'd had before that were on tape. So all of a sudden I had these two. They were on a different different medium. They sounded different. They were from different producers. They, you know, were from the early 80s, and I was listening in the early 90s. There were all these things differently. And as I was writing this blog post, trying to tease this out, trying to figure out what my history was and what all this mattered, I turned to Ambient Rhetoric, and I was looking for an interesting quote that would help me understand this circumstance. And I found this one where Rickert says, ambience puts place, language, and body into co-adaptive, vital, and buoyant interaction. And in the serendipitous way, that word buoyant got me thinking. Started thinking about what it means to be buoyant, to be afloat in water. And then I started thinking about the second REM album, Reckoning, which I've learned through reading Wikipedia, I never noticed on my own, that a lot of the lyrics do talk about water. And on the spine of the record, it said File Underwater. Some people originally even thought that was the title of the album, File Underwater. In a very REM sort of way, that very kind of confusing Southern Gothic, purposely obscured underwater sort of meanings, in some ways connected to the things I was already thinking about in Rickert. So I'm trying to decide, was that kairotic in the sense of me taking advantage of that moment? Was it choric in the sense of me stepping into the space of this blog and stepping into the space of this book and controlling it to say the things I wanted? It didn't feel that way to me. It felt more like I stepped into an interesting connection, and one that I love. That's my favorite part of that blog post, even though I don't even totally understand it.